Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 155, I'm joined by Dr. Jackie Duncan of the University of California, San Francisco. We discuss her research on quality of life improvements with the Argus II prosthesis and gene therapy, among other topics. A list of financial disclosures are attached to this episode in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now privileged to be joined by Dr. Jackie Duncan. Dr. Duncan is professor of clinical ophthalmology at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Duncan, thanks for joining us here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's your first time on the show. We ask the same first question to all of our guests, which is, why did you start in ophthalmology, and then why a particular interest in ophthalmic genetics and in retinal disease?
Well, those are great questions. I didn't know anything about ophthalmology until I was a third year medical student, and I really had no idea what I was going to do. But my first rotation at that time as a third year medical student was a 1 month rotation where you spent a week on each of the surgical subspecialties. And my first week was in ophthalmology, and I was just mesmerized by the amazing images, the ability to do surgery and see patients in clinic, to follow patients long-term, longitudinally, to get to know them over time, to see young patients and old patients, and to really have a meaningful impact in their quality of life. So I spent the rest of my medical school education trying to find something I liked as much, but was unsuccessful in doing that. And then when I was a resident, I had always kind of been interested in macular degeneration due to some affected family members. And similarly, just the retina was, you know, to me the most important part of the eye because it's the part that turns light into a message the brain can understand. The images are beautiful. The ability to sort of make meaningful impacts in patients' outcome was also very appealing to me. And the ability to see people longitudinally over time was something else I really desired. I was also interested in research, and so was introduced to a basic scientist in our department named Matt LaVale, who is an expert in inherited retinal degeneration, sort of in a preclinical sense, in terms of animal models and things like that. So got to know him and sought to complete a fellowship in inherited retinal degeneration so that I could pursue research with him after residency as a faculty member on a K grant. So it kind of happened very, you know, somewhat fortuitously, kind of step by step. I didn't really have a grand plan going in to do what I'm doing today, but it couldn't have turned out any better. I'm very pleased with how things worked out.
Let's segue and talk a little about K grants, national funding. I think that's something that, you know, a lot of us, we go into ophthalmology or any, you know, field within ophthalmology, and retina being one of them. And we all have maybe academic desires and pursuits, and some of us have more of a basic science bent, some of us have more translational clinical research bent. But the truth is that I think there's a lot of intimidation in the sense of trying to obtain funding, get a grant, a K that may lead to an R01. I mean, tell us a little bit about your experience. I mean, what sort of things do you think were most important in kind of staying the course? Because there are definitely challenges in terms of, you know, stressors and grants, deadlines, and getting things arranged. I think that can be a barrier for some people to overcome mentally. So if you do have, we do have listeners who are in their early parts of career thinking about going the grant pathway. I mean, what are sort of the things that helped you continue down that road and know that you were kind of checking all the boxes you need to get along, get good funding?
Well, those are great questions. I would say that for me, the thing that has been really most instrumental and most sort of impactful in my career has really been strong mentorship. I've had wonderful mentorship on the part of faculty members at UCSF who are now my colleagues, who were colleagues at the time, who encouraged me to pursue clinical translational research and to consider getting a K. Joan O'Brien was a faculty member at the time that convinced me that that was something to consider. Again, Matt LaVale was my basic science mentor who had a lot of interest in clinical applications of his research. And then my chair, Stephen McLeod, has been super supportive in terms of just helping me identify something that I think is fascinating, something about which I'm passionate, and then seeking out other people who share that same passion but may have a different set of skills from me. For example, Matt LaVeil is a basic scientist with expertise in inherited retinal degeneration, which I didn't have, although I was sort of interested in that field. And so he provided me with a very strong foundation of basic science and taught me about writing papers and writing grants and things like that career path, which I hadn't really been exposed to. I also worked closely with my mentors in my fellowship at Shea Eye Institute with Sam Jacobson, Arthur Sedisian, and Stuart Fine. Were all great mentors in terms of helping me understand the questions that we don't have good answers for, the vision-threatening diseases that were at the time, and at the time there really were no treatments at all for people with inherited retinal degenerations, and we didn't have great ways of looking at them. But right at that time, OCT was just being deployed to clinics, and during my fellowship, I learned a lot about that imaging modality. Different imaging modalities have since become, you know, more widely available. And, you know, the genetics of inherited retinal degenerations have really become a lot more clearly understood, although we learn more every day. And now we're at the point where we have an FDA-approved treatment for our patients with inherited retinal degenerations caused by mutations in the RPE65 gene. And sort of, I could never have envisioned any of that being the case when I started this path. But, through working with really brilliant people and pursuing passion that I thought was really fascinating and important, I've been fortunate to sort of take advantage of lots of really exciting developments that have happened in the field. And I think the area I chose, kind of by accident, has become a really important one, a really important area of growth for the future for our field.
Let's talk a little bit about thalmogenetics. Obviously, it's an extremely exciting time for the field. I think all thalmogenetics is found every time exciting, but right now, we have the first FDA-approved subretinal gene therapy, which has been discussed in numerous venues over the last, 14, 15 months since the approval of Luxturna. And let's just talk about gene therapy in general. And I feel I always ask different people in the field kind of their thoughts about the subretinal space as an access point. There's been also discussion now of the intravitreal oligonucleotide, and maybe that the intravitreal space may be accessible for certain diseases depending on the mutation. Mm-hmm. But first of all, do you think the subretinal space is ultimately going to be our target as an access point for gene therapy for retinal diseases? And if so, do you think that the vitrectomy subretinal space access versus a suprachoroidal access, which has been discussed before, do you think one of them is going to be more viable than the other? Knowing that Luxturna is through the vitrectomy route, do you think that future technologies will follow the same sort of methodology, or do you think they'll approach more of an external route to accessing that space?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't really know for sure. I will say that for primary photoreceptor degenerations, the target is photoreceptors. So you have to get the treatment to the cells or it's not going to be effective. Delivery to the subretinal space gives you best access to the photoreceptors that have yet to degenerate. That being said, it's already a sick photoreceptor. You're already dealing with a sick retina, and to create a retinal detachment and expect it to settle down without any evidence of sequelae or harm to the cells, is asking a lot. And it's possible and maybe likely that the subretinal space is, although it's the target that you want to seek, creating a retinal detachment may be causing harm that may not be facilitating the most the greatest impact of the treatment that you may be seeking to obtain. So a suprachoroidal space may be a way to go. I know there's a lot of work being done to develop viral vectors that can penetrate the ILM and approach the photoreceptors from a vitreous route. There's companies working on that. Certainly for some diseases, like X-linked retinoschisis, it is likely that you could use an intravitreal approach. However, whenever you put a viral vector into the vitreous, there's maybe a greater chance of inflammation in response to that viral capsid. So I think suprachoroidal approaches, different kinds of approaches are really going to be critical to be able to effectively deliver these therapies as they're developed to the target photoreceptors, because treatments don't cross the blood-retina barrier for a reason. And if you want to really access the photoreceptors somehow, that sort of drug delivery of these types of treatments to the photoreceptors continues to be a really important problem that I don't think we've solved yet.
Yeah, one of the other things you've written papers about and discussed is talking about the ARGUS-2, which is a different approach to kind of inherited diseases. Rather than gene therapy, it's essentially providing a different sort of stimulation to healthy intact nerve fiber layer in the ganglion cells that are still intact in patients with retinitis pigmentosa, for example. And you've written about, published about the visual quality of life improvements, which I think is an interesting thing because traditional measures maybe don't capture the quality of life improvements that a technology like that confers. And that's important from a scientific reason. It's also important for practical reasons, because if you have a very expensive technology and you want the government and other insurers to approve it, you need to, it's helpful to show that yes, it does indeed objectively improve quality of life. So talk a little bit about what sort of measures do you use for those patients to show quality of life improvements, and what did your research demonstrate in the end?
Yeah, that's been another big challenge. As we start to develop therapies for patients with profound vision loss or, you know, very advanced vision loss, you have a lot of opportunity to help them because they really, you know, any improvement is really tremendously impactful for patients. But you're right, it's asking a lot to be able to ask them to sort of read letters on a chart and expect them to see 20/20 is probably not realistic. So I know that Second Sight at the time was struggling with this question and developed this thing called FLORA, which was a functional evaluation of patients' quality of life and their ability to perform tasks that were meaningful and important to them in their home environment. And they had low vision specialists that were trained specifically in these assessments to test how well patients were able to navigate in their room and do certain, you know, activities of daily living and things like that in their home environments, which were really important in enabling them to obtain HUD approval for that device. So the FDA, as you correctly said, really cares a lot about how patients benefit from a different intervention, from whatever the intervention may be. A lot of work is being done to develop new ways of measuring vision in people with very low vision, including patient-reported outcomes, which is what, you know, the patient tells you that they're experiencing, as well as other more objective measures like mobility tasks and other kinds of observed activities. So that is another really important area of research that has a lot of potential as we begin to enter the era where we can actually restore some sight to people with profound vision loss, and without being able to document and carefully quantify the impact that those types of interventions have on people with profoundly reduced vision, we're not going to get to a point that we can convince the FDA that these are treatments that are helpful. So that's a really important area of research that a lot of investigators and companies and different types of people are exploring right now and developing.
In terms of your other research, you know, you've looked at OCTA, again, another area where people are doing extensive research. And one of the interesting things I was reading in the publication was talking about choriocapillaris flow and its relation to geographic atrophy, which I think is fascinating. So talk a little bit for listeners who aren't familiar about, you know, the OCTA technology for looking at geographic atrophy, and what does the correlation you found imply in terms of maybe the disease mechanism?
Well, so OCTA is a great development, and honestly, I'm a little new to the field compared to many other people who have more extensive experience than I have. However, we've used OCTA technique to look at the perfusion of choriocapillaris in collaboration with Ricky Wong and his lab at University of Washington, and Dan Schwartz here at UCSF. We studied patients using OCTA as well as adaptive optic scanning laser ophthalmoscopy, which is a technique I have more experience with, to try and look at which tissues were more profoundly affected in patients with geographic atrophy, with a hope of understanding like what the most meaningful target might be for different kinds of interventions that might slow down disease progression. And so we found that in patients with geographic atrophy, the area of geographic atrophy certainly has severely reduced choroidal perfusion, but we found that there's also reduced choroidal perfusion around the margins, which suggested that the reduced choroidal perfusion may contribute to progression of geographic atrophy. We are doing studies right now on some of those patients longitudinally to see if that prediction is going to be holding up or bearing out. And so, you know, stay tuned. But we definitely found a correlation between worse choriocapillaris perfusion or increased flow voids, which just means it may be that there's perfusion there, but it may be slow and just hard to measure at the edges of geographic atrophy compared to areas further away from the edge, which makes us think that perhaps the reduced perfusion in the choroid might contribute to the fact that there's geographic atrophy there, you know, alternatively, perhaps something else is causing the geographic atrophy and also damaging the choriocapillaris. So it's not clear which is, you know, the causative factor, but we definitely see a correlation between those two things, and we think it may help us predict which patients are likely to experience progression and where that progression will occur over time.
So last thing before you go, Dr. Duncan, obviously you've seen tremendous changes in the last few years in terms of retina ophthalmic genetics, and there's been big breakthroughs both on for retinal vascular disease and now for hereditary disease. If you're projecting ahead, and again, when you put your fortune teller cap on and kind of look ahead, for the younger ophthalmologists who are coming out of training, the next 5 to 10 years, I mean, what do you think that most of these diseases will be treated by general retina specialists? Do you think that most retina specialists will have to be comfortable with these diseases as the technology? For example, like subretinal surgery does require vitrectomy, so maybe there will be, as we get more of these patients' hereditary disease, we may have an increased burden slash number of these patients who need procedures done. Is this something that you think will have to become more central to the education over the next generation of vitreoretinal fellows?
That is really important. So it depends on what mode of delivery ends up being the most safe and effective. But at this point in time, certainly given the approval of Luxturna, people are using or pursuing treatment approaches with assuming that people will undergo vitrectomy and create a retinal detachment and deliver the vector right into the subretinal space. And so it is absolutely true that just being trained in a standard vitreoretinal fellowship does not necessarily provide you with the experience that is required to deliver this kind of therapy to the subretinal space. And the experience doing that is really limited to the people, sort of limited at this point to people who were involved in the clinical trials and then the people that they have trained. So they're starting to disseminate the information more broadly. Right now, Luxturna is only available at a small number of sites in the United States. And so I think in addition to becoming more familiar with that kind of approach, perhaps even more important is for the general retinal specialist and the general ophthalmologist to be more comfortable assessing patients that may present to their clinic with reduced night vision or side vision or whatever it may be, and evidence of photoreceptor loss in terms of diagnosing those patients, characterizing them clinically, and then importantly, making sure they have access to genetic testing so you can identify the genetic cause of their vision loss is going to be increasingly important. So retinal specialists really should, I would encourage for the next near future, retinal specialists to become more knowledgeable about and more comfortable evaluating patients with these kinds of diseases, being more comfortable talking to them about what the field, what the newest some of the newest developments in the field offer, so patients are not just told that they have these devastating inherited diseases that are going to cause them to lose all their vision, but instead that there's a lot of research going on, which for some patients has resulted in an FDA-approved treatment that is available for them right now. Being able to get people genetically characterized, clinically characterized, referred for clinical trials and treatments when those are available, and importantly supported with low vision consultation is going to be, I think, a really important fundamental part of really every retinal specialist training and ideally every ophthalmologist training going forward.
I'll ask one last question before I let you go. You know, and we referenced this when we were talking about measuring quality of life improvements in ARGUS patients. In addition to us being more comfortable with these diseases, do you think we're going to have to significantly change the way we measure function? And, you know, visual acuity in trials, for example, use ETRS vision, and just on a day-to-day basis, we use visual acuity and maybe OCT, which has obviously added a lot to our understanding of macular disease and retinal disease. Are we going to have different measures for outcome, you know, that are more objective than simply, you know, subjective survey or questionnaire?
Yeah, I think those are really important points. I think for broad predominant diseases, OCT and visual acuity is not going to be a sensitive indicator that there's a problem. So people need to become more comfortable with measures of peripheral visual field and ideally measures of rod function, whether that be full field ERG testing or scotopic perimetry, which can be done at a number of centers. If it's not something you have access to at your location, please know places that you can refer patients so that they can get well characterized and find out what the correct diagnosis is for them so that they can be aware of potential treatment options and trials that they could benefit from in the future. In addition, help them understand what the hereditary basis in their family may be so they can be aware of other family members who may be at risk.
Well, Dr. Duncan, our listeners will really appreciate the time you spent with us today. Thank you again for educating all of us and sharing, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thanks a lot for including me in this podcast. I really enjoyed it.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 155 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. It has a relatively new feature where two of our bright medical students reflect on the latest episode and offer their perspective. You can also sign up for the mailing list on the website. That will give you email updates of the most recent episodes that they come out. You can also subscribe to the Apple Podcast Store or the Android Store so you get updates on your smartphone. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Apple Store or Android Store to please leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Duncan for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Vinicasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.